Nick.
Oh, I'm Nick, I'm an addict.
Hi, Nick.
Hi. Right? Yeah, never done this microphone turnout before. Could be dangerous for my ego, the microphone, I think. So I am sitting here, a cross between thinking I've got nothing to say to anybody of any worth to, do you know how lucky you are to have me talking to you tonight? Pretty much. That could be the end of the chair, really, for me. So that pretty much sums me up in a nutshell. I went to a family funeral in Norwich. And even that, I thought, you've had a result getting me there, up to Norwich. And I really felt that as I was driving into Norwich. And I was thinking, my family should be so glad that I'm doing this for them. And then I got to the funeral, I was thinking, they were looking at me like they hate me. And I barely knew the geezer was dead as well. So, where to start? I'm trying to have a baby at the moment. Well, I'm not trying to have a baby, but my partner is trying to have a baby at the moment. And due to my complications when I was a kid, basically from having mumps and doing a lot of glue when I was like 13, good combo, mumps and glue. The combination of mumps and glue has left me infertile, which I found out last year, which is another story. But the reason I'm telling you is because we're doing this sperm donor thing at the moment, this programme. This is not a joke, by the way, this is serious. I wish it was a joke, let me tell you. So, doing this sperm donor thing, and we're on these websites, and we've gone Danish, exotic. Why is that funny? So we've gone to Danish. They're peaceful people, and I've got to tell you, I'm really not trying to get a laugh here. I don't know why I'm laughing. But we're looking at these things, and actually nowadays, what you get when you go into these sperm donor places is you get an amazing amount of detail of the people, anonymous, and there's a massive, great big world out there which I knew nothing about. So we're on this website, and we find this young cat, and basically Alice, my partner, is she's looking at the characteristics of this kid. There's a point to this, and it's basically she's looking at the characteristics, and this kid is in his mid-20s. He's basically written on his sheet what he's like as a person, you know, and what he was like growing up and everything. And she's sitting there. Now, I've known her 5.5 years, Alice. She's sitting there sort of going, this kid, he calls himself gentle, attentive, communicative, right? And she's going, oh, that reminds me of you, you know. And and I was, of course, thinking, now, if I was a kid and I was writing that, I would be saying, withdrawn, shy, outgoing and shy, doesn't want to be noticed, wants to be the centre of attention, hates everybody but wants everybody to like him. You know where I'm going. It's the story of all of our lives, is the fact that, you know, so I'm looking at this kid and he's giving an honest appraisal of what he's like. And what I'm saying is, my girlfriend, my partner, she just has no idea what she's dealing with in terms of, you know, what I was like as a kid, as an addict, you know, with drugs, without drugs, the whole sort of story of my life. And in a funny sort of way, it shows me how far I've come, because, of course, the person that she's looking at now, you know, I can't, on a good day, I can be attentive, I can be caring, I can be kind, you know what I mean? Treated, I can be kind. You know, treated, I can be caring. And I mean treated as in staying in the middle of this. Now, you know, I've been clean for a while, and you know... doing a chair, and there's a massive drum roll doing a chair, I've got to tell you, but doing a chair in a meeting like this where there's no feedback, it is about giving your experience. You know, it really is about sharing your experience. And I have been clean for a fairly long time for someone of my age, and I have basically grown up my whole adult life. It's been in a fellowship. I got clean when I was a teenager, and I'm 42 now. You know, I was in my first mental hospital when I was 16, first rehab when I was 17. And I've been in and around this program ever since then. And so my whole grown-up existence has been formed by recovery or not recovery, you know, because I've had a lot of friends that have gone out and died, as anyone has been clean for a couple of decades would tell you. And, you know, the person that's here now is it's such a difference from the person I was, A, growing up, B, getting clean, and then C, being here today. And, you know, it is without doubt far and above the most important thing I've ever done, will ever do, because it forms the basis of your whole life. Because for me, I'm 25 years clean, and when I think about using, I do not think about sitting there with a Chardonnay chewing the fat with a few thespians. I think about getting up King's Cross and getting right on it. Do you know what I mean? And that's 25 years later. You know what I mean? And it just has never changed. It's never changed. I've never ever thought I've outrun this illness. I've never thought I'm feeling like I've got it sussed. You know, I've never. I mean, God's gift to me is He's left me feeling desperate after 25 years. That's the truth of it. That's really God's best present He's ever given me. Is basically the fact that I've never got to that nirvana that you never hear people talking about in here anyway. But I've never got to that place where I've ever really thought I'm out of the woods now. You know what I mean? I've got it. I mean, what does out of the woods mean? Does it mean feeling good? Does it mean having a few quid in your pocket? It's so hypothetical anyway, being sorted in recovery, because it's just, for me, it's just a series of, not even hurdles, but it's just a series of, I don't know what it is, but what I do know is the best, weirdly, ironically, the best things that have ever happened to me in recovery have been the most painful things. And, you know, like saying the microphone, you know, would be dangerous for me because of my ego potentially. You know, the antidote to ego is humility. You know, so I've learned that in recovery. And when I got clean in 1987, I didn't have a clue. This is a whole language. This is like learning Russian, do you know what I mean, when you get clean. Coming in here and listening to people talk about their feelings and losing the street talk that we all come in here with, the slang of the street, and to talk in a language where you talk about your feelings, it is so difficult. And anyone who gets clean and stays clean, you know, I would constantly, I'll take my hat, I don't even wear a hat, but I mean, you know, I'm constantly sort of amazed by people that get clean, you know, because it's not easy. It's so not easy. First of all, it's not easy to put, whether it's crack wearing or whatever you're doing, smoking dope, doesn't really matter. It's first of all, it's not easy to put drugs down for a day or two. But the most important thing that I've ever felt is that the hardest thing is to live with yourself. Putting the drugs down is literally the tip of the iceberg. Do you know what I mean? Unfortunately, if it was that easy, there'd be a lot more people getting clean, you know. And I got clean in 1987. I went from the Maudsley. I was in a section in the Maudsley. They didn't even, really, in the 80s, they didn't even know what junkies were. And, you know, they basically just sectioned everyone that was a junkie. I either went to the Bethlehem for a black box detox. I thought that was really cool. I thought something like the Houdini was in the, you know, the black. I never got to the black box because I didn't have a bad enough habit, you know. And I went, I got sectioned. And I was with a lot of lunatics, you know what I mean? I was with people that are trying to cut themselves all the time. I just cut myself all the time as well, actually. But I would consider them to be real lunatics. How I got off the section was I went to Cloud's house, and that was in those days. I think that was that and one place in Western Supermare were the only 12-step treatment centres in the whole of Britain or something. And you know, I know the fellowship started in the sort of early 80s in England, and it was tiny in Chelsea, and you know, but when I got clean, it wasn't that much bigger than that, and there was a few meetings around, and you know, I got to Cloud's house, and I I can tell you how I felt. The first thing I felt was I felt relieved to be off the street. And the reason I felt relieved to be off the street is because I was not a good junkie. Because being an addict, I was scared. My conscience kicked in the most weirdest of places. Do you know what I mean? In the middle of creeping someone's house, like up on the first floor, about to go into a kid's bedroom, I'd be like, oh no, what am I doing? Do you know what I mean? About to go and rob them off their little... remember the piggies are waiting for you. The piggies. I remember the little piggy banks, ever chawing all the piggy banks, getting coins out of them and everything. But getting really mad attacks of conscience in the most odd places and just thinking, you know what, this is not you. This is not you. And I had mates who were much more seasoned than me, whether they're older than me or whatever, it wasn't the point. The point is they didn't look like they had the same level of difficulty in dealing with being a street junkie, you know, and... I struggled with it, and so when I got into the Maudsley, I was pleased to be off the street. I was, as a junkie, I was a fraud, because I was a fraud all my life. I was a fraud. You know what I mean? I was more obsessed with drug culture than any drug itself. Do you know what I mean? I loved the idea. I grew up in the heroin screws you up era. Do you know what I mean? And like everybody that saw those posters, I thought, yep, that's what I want to be, properly screwed up. Do you know what I mean? And that's not even, you know, that was so true in those days, you know. And but I felt like a fraud. I didn't feel like anything I did really sort of came from me. I felt like I was nicking bits of personalities. Do you know what I mean? The older boys around the flats, you know, the kids that used to chase gear, I used to nick their personalities. You know, I nicked accents from people. Do you know what I mean? My whole persona was a mix-up of things that I thought I should be, that would make me cool, that would make me interesting, that would make me more sort of provocative or whatever. And I didn't know where I was in that. You know, my mum and dad are lower middle class. My dad's militantly right-wing. My mum was so far left, she was borderline lesbian. Do you know what I mean? No. I'm not saying that as a joke. I'm saying she was, but, you know, she's bisexual. What's funny about that? But I grew up with a complete polarity of influences from my mum and dad, you know. So I was all over the place as a kid, you know. And that sort of dogged me right the way through getting clean and everything, you know. Who am I and where do I fit in and where's my place in the world, you know. But it was really prevalent when I was using, was the fact that I just... You know, I remember being in God, man, I remember, you know, I grew up in the jazz funk era in South London in the 80s, and I was into that, but I'd also met loads of, like, mad hippies that went to Pink Floyd, lived in squats in South London in the 80s, so I was diving around into AC/DC, then jazz funk down the Old Kent Road, and I didn't know where I was, do you know what I mean? I'm changing my clobber every time, I'd bike a leather jacket, and I'd beachy and a pair of feeler tracks, or whatever it was, I was jumping around. And that... How can you know that at the time, that you are effectively taking personalities to try and make yourself feel whole, you know? And that's tiring, anyone who's done that, and I presume 100% of the people in this room have done that at some point. And that's very tiring. So when I got clean, there was a sense of relief, do you know what I mean? And the truth is, I had no idea what this was. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I had a few court cases hanging on my head, and I'd upset some people that I was way out of my depth with through drugs, and, you know, I was scared of what was going to happen to me, because suddenly my best mate got murdered a couple of months before, and it suddenly felt like it was getting very real, taking drugs, and it wasn't just sitting around sharing joints or whatever. It was getting real, and I didn't fancy that, you know what I mean? My cowardice, not cowardice, because it was actually proper fear. I don't know what it was, but it kicked in. And so when I got off the street, I was happy. And as I say, I knew nothing about this. What? You know, so I coasted for a short amount of time on being clean. You know, there's a massive euphoria, I think, in getting clean. And being buzzheads, we're all looking for euphorias, do you know what I mean? And so there is a weird natural high in getting clean, I think. And, you know, everyone coming up to you and the learning and the sort of, you get off on it. You know, I really got off on it, and people coming into you. And just like most addicts, you know, people only ever ask me for, you know, who, where, what, why, drugs, all that sort of stuff, you know. So when people started kind of like showing kindness and, you know, being interested, I really sort of got off on that, you know. But for me, there were a few really key sort of turning points in the whole journey for me. And one was, so what happened to me was, I stayed clean for a while, and after a few months, I relapsed. I think the real reason I relapsed, because I felt like the attention had gone off me. And I liked the fact that everyone was making a fuss of you when you first get clean. And then it felt to me like it became a bit mundane. And I think there was a lot of deeper stuff going on for me, was the fact that I was a teenager, and I was looking at my life going, I've not been to school, I don't know where I'm going, I don't know what I'm going to do, I'm just going to use again. I can't deal with it. I can't deal with the idea of getting on a dole or getting to get a job, or I can't face it. I'm out of this. And so I used again. And I spent, which is the worst time, I think, for me was the worst time, and is the worst time, I suppose, for any addict, is when you're in and out and you're back bouncing backwards and forwards, in and out of meetings, getting a few days clean. And what I never gave credit for, and I never really listened in the readings, was the fact that once you take the first drug, you don't know where you're going to go. And I just didn't give that, I didn't pay attention to that. And, you know, when I relapsed, the first thing I did was drink a can of Barbican. I don't even think you can buy Barbican anymore. Barbican was an alcohol-free lager. And I went into an offie in South London and I bought two cans of Barbican. And in my mind, I was thinking, this will show them. This will show all of that ANA mob, right, what I'm about. And I had my two cans of Barbican. And I opened the first one and I had two swigs of it and I went straight across the road, back in the offie, eight cans of Stella, bang, that dude, lagging drunk. An hour later I'd scored, 3 hours later I got beaten up, 12 hours later I was nicked. You know what I mean? And that was like, whoa! Things ain't changed, that was good, you know what I mean? It was really... And I woke up in a sort of haze, you know, and there was even people like... And I woke up in some sort of... I was in a squash in the fire station, and there were people there that were like, bang on junkies, you know what I mean? With all holes down their arms and legs and going, you want to get clean again, mate? You're in trouble. While they're sitting there going, crash, you know what I mean? But what happened then was I couldn't stay clean. You know, I could get a day clean, and what I was doing, I was going from London back down to Western Supermare, back to London, scoring, going back down to Western Supermare, and I got on that treadmill, and that treadmill's hard to get off. And you know, people that have relapsed know what that's like, and it's, you know, it's a familiar story in NA, sadly, of relapse, and it's tough to get off it. And you know, I was in a probation hostel in Western Supermare in 1987. And I remember the swirly nylon duvet in the bedroom that I was in. That's all I remember. And, you know, I had my little dustbin sack full of all my bits and pieces. I Wish You Were Here on my cassette player. And that was me. Do you know what I mean? I actually had a Donkey Kong game as well. But I just couldn't get it. And I was going to meetings, and I was trying to listen to what people used to say, and I went to meetings lagging, I went to meetings out of my head. And you know, when you're... There's a limit of when someone is wanting to get help, you get swarmed by people in NA. Do you know what I mean? Because there is no kinder place on earth, in my experience. When you're being hostile and drunk and being aggressive, people give you a wide berth. Do you know what I mean? Because that's the nature of the beast. And I was doing that, and I was in Western, and I was in meetings, I was hooting. Do you know what I mean? And people just completely dropped me out. And, you know, I had that experience that I'd had when I was supposed to be at school, when I hadn't been at school, when I was like 15 years old. And I had a moment of cool in my school, do you know what I mean? I had one moment where I'd become the bad boy before I went out of control and before I started turning the friendships against me, which is what I always used to do, where people thought, he's a bit rock and roll, that Nicky, do you know what I mean? He's taking drugs and he's gone a bit dangerous. And I was like, I like that reputation, you know, gripper out of Grange Hill, I thought. But it didn't take long before people didn't see the funny side in what I was doing and got a bit wary about me and didn't like what went with the sort of slightly out of control behaviour. And I remember one of the most moments of clarity I had when I was using was when kids that I went to school with that a couple of years ago thought I was a little bit hip and a little bit edgy completely crossed the road when they saw me, do you know what I mean? And they put their nuts down, they pretended they'd never seen me. And I was half sort of going to show out, and I thought, I'm going to humiliate myself in front of them, so I just carried on walking. And it got me, that did. I felt there was something not right about that. And that's what happened in Weston-super-Mare, because it's a small town, of being on the treadmill of relapse, people just started to sort of avoid you, do you know what I mean? And there was a lot of, you know, there was a real sense of this is the end, do you know what I mean? This is lonely. And, you know, when people in AA don't want to have it with you, you're really on the floor. And so I had my moment of clarity in London, in someone's house at 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning, having been out for 3 days. And I just sat there, and I can remember it like it was yesterday, sitting on someone's bed, and they went to make me a cup of coffee to try and liven me up. And I had this massive ringing in my ears where I hadn't been to bed. And I just thought, this is not, you ain't going to carry on like this. You just can't do this, you know what I mean? There is nothing there. And I literally ran out of this geezer's house, and I went to my mum's down the road. I said to her, Mum, I need 20 quid to get back down to Weston. She wouldn't give me 20 quid, she thought I'd go to school. So she took me to Paddington, put me on the train, and I went back down to Weston-super-Mare, and I've never used since. And the first thing that happened to me in recovery was I went to a meeting, and I was about 3 or 4 days clean at that point, and I went to a meeting in Weston-super-Mare, and it was a grim Weston-super-Mare, it still is, but it was very grim then. And I went to a meeting, and there was a gang of addicts. There were sort of 4 or 5 of them, and they were like the Weston-super-Mare coolies, do you know what I mean? And they were probably from Bath or somewhere, and I thought, oh, they're really hip, these cats. And they were the sort of, you know, the in kind of NA people, and I so wanted them to fucking show out to me, do you know what I mean? I so wanted a bit of acknowledgement from them. And one of them, who I still know today, you know, they were walking out of the meeting, and one of them said to me, what are you doing, mate? Do you want to come for a cup of coffee with us? And I can't tell you what that done to me. You know what I mean? I cannot tell you the power of someone reaching out to me and saying to me, do you want to be on with us? It literally, I don't know, and of course I went, no, I'm sweet. I've actually got to go back to the hostel, funny enough. No, I don't exactly know what happened. I think I probably went, no, but I probably will, you know. And of course I went for coffee with him, and I couldn't open my mouth, and I was like a sort of div sitting there. And it was, you know, it was so big for me, that stuff, because it was just about my life. That was about me wanting to be liked, and it was the core of my addiction. That was the core of me, wanting to be part of something, which is why I was so ripe for NA. You know, it was the absolute, it was the fibre of my life, was wanting to be loved, wanting to be paid attention to, wanting to be taken seriously, you know, all of those things that I never felt I'd had. So I had this coffee, and I remember a couple of days later, it was Glastonbury, and they wouldn't let me go, and I sort of become a little bit pally with them, and had to be careful that I didn't go too strong, because that was the story of my life. I'd get a friend, and I'd just wear them into the ground, you know what I mean? I was the sort of kid that if I'd met you 3 times, I'd find out where you live, I'd be on the door, Tommy coming out, and be like, it's dark, what are you doing? You know, that was me. I was a very enthusiastic kid. I loved being around people, you know. I had a lot to say, as you can see. And I remember being a small boy, and, you know, sitting on people's walls, waiting for the lights to come on in their flat. You know what I mean? Waiting for their mums to sort of go, well, you can go out of him now, the lunatic on the street. You know what I mean? And that was me. And so when people did it in NA, it was huge. It was absolutely huge for me. And these four blokes, and they were all about a year clean, and I was about 4 or 5 days clean, whatever it was. They lived on, in Weston-super-Mare, there was a couple of piers, and they lived on a pier, and a cool house, sort of bit kind of like random, you know. They lived in this house, and they were super cool, we had barbecues and all that, and, you know, there were meetings going on around there. It was a really, like, good scene, you know, as far as I was concerned. And I was in a probation hostel, another one, and there was 3 bedrooms and 4 fellas, and in one of the bedrooms, there was a spare bed. And I used to go around there every day, and I thought, that is my bed. I want that bed. Do you know what I mean? My name's on that bed. And I slowly started dropping hints about sort of, you know, anyone, you know, unable to just say, do you know what? I really like you guys. I think you're really cool. I just want to be with, not in that way, but I just want to hang out with you, and I want you to like me, you know. It was all sort of hinge of it. And after about 15 days clean, they said to me, they called me in, you know, into the thing, and said to me, we've had a little confab, and if you get 30 days clean, that bed's yours. And I can't tell you the feelings that were going on. It was like the excitement of being a kid at Christmas again, do you know what I mean? Of that adrenaline of inability to sleep, couldn't eat. I'm talking about getting a shitty, sorry about the swearing, but a shitty bed in a fucking pier in Western Supermare, and I was obsessed with it, you know, because of what it really meant. And so, and I literally counted down the days. I was counting down the days to get to that, to get to 30 days, you know what I mean? And those guys, I mean, they did, because many years later I could tell them, but they had no idea of the significance of that was in my life. And that was the difference for me of staying on that treadmill of relapse or thinking, I've got something to go for here. I'm going to do it. I'm going to get this NA game, you know what I mean? And so I got to 30 days clean, and I was in my probation hostel, my little dustbin sack, Floyd, Donkey Kong. And I was ready at 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, I had nothing to pack. I had a couple of old Armani jumpers, and I had nothing else. And so I was sitting there waiting for them to come. And of course, and one of them was a carpet fitter, a man called Simon. He's a carpet fitter. So he had a van, and they said, "We'll come pick you up in the van," you know. And I often wonder, thinking back on it, did it mean anything to them? As it, you know, did it mean as much to them as it meant to me? And they said they were coming at 9 in the morning, of course, 9:15, and they weren't there. And I was like, oh, you know, the usual thing of disappointment of, you know, I played it a bit too strong. And they came and they picked me up, and I stuck my sack in the back, and we drove towards the pier, and there was a little square windows on the... I just remember it like it was yesterday, and I watched my old life disappear away from me. And it was the beginning of a life you cannot imagine, the life I've had in the a quarter of a century, the life I've had, the life I've built in NA, the twists and the turns and the ups and the downs and the failures and the triumphs, and it's just been an amazing, amazing journey for me. And how long have I got?
10 minutes.
Ten
left, yeah.
Well, it's all started. No, I'm joking. The thing, the most important thing that happened to me in recovery, the another big turning point for me was I was clean for a couple of years, and I was going to meetings, and I was doing what everyone does, which is get on the circuit, get busy, get commitments, you know what I mean? Try and steam into every female into the fellowship, and just do what most people do, you know, go to conventions, all that sort of stuff. And I was sort of slightly coasting with it all, you know, and I had a sort of sponsor. And the first sponsor I ever had, he was a weightlifter, and that's why I wanted him as a sponsor, because he had massive arms. And, he had nothing to say of any value at all. But I used to go to a gym with him in Western Supermare, and he'd go, "Yeah, mate, spot me." And I'd be sort of... And that was my first sponsor. I don't think he had said of anything to me, of any use. And so I was slightly sort of coasting on the whole NA thing. And the big turning point for me was I fell in love with someone when I was 2 years clean. I fell in love with a girl, and the story was this, that she never felt the same about me as I felt about her. And I spent a year trying to get this girl to fall in love with me, and I couldn't. And she quite liked me at first. She went, you know, she liked me enough to go out with me, you know, but... Being an addict, it wasn't enough for me just to go out with someone. It had to be like mad, passionate love. It had to be like moving in. It had to be everything. Obviously, it wasn't going to be kids. But it had to be the whole thing for me. And I done that typical addict thing of I went stronger and stronger and stronger with her. And the stronger I went, the more she started to pull away, because she was a young woman trying to live her life. And I got more and more obsessive, and she pulled away further. And the pain... of having those feelings of someone and there's nothing you can do about the way they feel about you, it was killing me. It was killing me. I went through months of not being able to eat properly and just doing like 80 snout a day, and I was in pieces. And the worst thing was is I couldn't share it in meetings, and I was so ashamed of the way I felt that I couldn't go into a meeting and say, do you know what, I feel utterly, utterly bereft and humiliated by this person. And they're not even anything special. I mean, it's easy to say that now. At the time, I did think that. But it's not about them. It's about me. And it's about the fact I couldn't have what I wanted. And it was really, really hurting me. And I almost turned stalker, I will say that, you know. I had a couple of nights of watching across... Oh. Delete that. Oh, Lord. I used to watch her. Oh, man, alive. You know. In any case, one day, it was so painful for me. As we all do, we have to know. And so after a year of being bounced around by her, I said to her, I've got to know, are we going anywhere? And she went, no, sorry. And she dumped me. And it was, you know, the usual freefall. I just went into complete freefall when someone told me they didn't love me in the way that I loved them. And I just span out of control. I was like a leaf being blown around. I had no idea. I was so winded by what this woman, girl had said to me, by what she'd done to me, or what I thought she'd done to me, that I remember staggering up the Holland Park. I was staggering. I was like a punch drunk boxer. I had no idea where I was going, and I days turned into weeks of not being able to sleep and sleeping at random hours and everything. And there's a point to this, by the way. And I went for at least 30 days from the moment she dumped me of not being able to go to a meeting because of the shame I felt of being able to sit down and say, do you know what? It ain't what I want it to be. It's not working out the way I want it to be. My life is not the way I forecast it. And eventually, someone dragged me to a meeting in Hammersmith, and all I can say is I shared, and the floor had puddles on it. I mean, the floor was wet with crying, and I mean, it was literally a pit going, excuse me, mate, you're fucking crying for 15 minutes here. You know what I mean? Enough, mate. I couldn't stop crying. I was crying my soul out, not my eyes, you know, and it was the beginning of something special for me, and it was about the fact that it is so important for me to be able to come in here and tell you what's going on. Good, bad, indifferent, boring, mundane, exciting, whatever it is, I suddenly realised the importance of the fellowship. And it was like for 2 years I'd coasted. I was in and out, I was a social, snouting outside all the time, or actually inside in those days. But I was it was a social club for me. And I was happy to be clean and I was out of the woods, but I wasn't taking it seriously. And one thing I've learned is that you only get out what you put in. And when I started to put into this fellowship, when I fucked the weightlifter off, when I started to get a proper sponsor, you know, when I started to look at the green and gold book, and when I started to look at the steps and everything, my life started to change. And my life started to change not in the way that I got a job and I felt confident around women for the first time and I felt like I had a bit of smooth dialogue. It was nothing to do with that. It was about the fact that I started to think that I could actually spend 10 minutes sitting by myself without sort of going, snout. Oh, yeah. It was that. And it was... Really, what I've done in this fellowship is I've thawed. And this quarter of a century has been about thawing for me, you know. And it's taken this long. But I'm going to tell you, the really, really good news is that it has got so much better. It has got so much better. The ability to sort of sit within unresolved problems. And my story of my life was I could not sit with something unless it was sorted. And I would be up all night trying to deal with things, you know what I mean? Because I couldn't live within unresolved problems. And I've learnt to. And I've learnt to, you know, be able to talk in front of people. And I couldn't do that, you know what I mean? I just couldn't do it because I felt like what I had to say was rubbish. You know, I've had an amazing journey and I've got a really great job and a great career and everything, and it's been great for me, and it's been, you know, but I mean, I don't know what my recovery would be like if I didn't have a job, if I was this time clean and not working. I don't know what it would be like, but my story is that I am, do you know what I mean? And it just goes hand in hand. And I've definitely learnt, because I've had periods in recovery of drifting away from the fellowship, you know, I've put other things in front of it, mostly women, and money, and I've lost them both, you know, everything I've put in front of the fellowship. And again, it sounds like such a terrible cliche, but everything I've put in front of my recovery, I've lost. it's all come to nothing. Do you know what I mean? And I've always ended up back in the fellowship on my knees going, oh, please, God, I won't do it again. Do you know what I mean? I'll be a better addict, you know. I'll do more tea commitments, whatever it is, you know. And humiliated and humbled again, you know. And as I said earlier, God's gift for me really genuinely is desperation. And it's not like I spend my life feeling desperate. I don't feel desperate. I feel desperate very small amounts of time, really. But there's something about... the only time that is when I'm really, really in the moment is when I'm in recovery and hurting and feeling what... I don't know what it is. It's such a weird thing, but people know what I'm talking about, maybe. But I know for me that it's the most important... It is the most important thing that I've ever done because, you know, how could you... You couldn't live 25 years without, you know, as an addict. You can maybe live a year or two, you know, but you can't live a long life and sort of not take this seriously. And, you know, that I've grown... That definitely, the thing I'm going to finish on is that the really great thing for me as well is that my love for the fellowship and my commitment to the fellowship has fortunately grown rather than diminished. And I've had friends and who knows... what God does in terms of who he picks to stay the distance, or I don't know that. That's not my story, do you know what I mean? But all I know is that I'm lucky because I started off not taking this seriously, and now I cling to this like a life raft now. And I let people know straight away that I'm a lunatic addict, do you know what I mean? Because it's where I want to be. And I didn't want to be there at 5 years clean, at 10 years clean. I thought I was a bit too cool for it, do you know what I mean? I drifted off, and I've always ended up back here on my knees. And so that's my story, but it's a great journey for me, and that'll do me. Thanks a lot. Thanks.